Thanks, Purple Singer, and good to see Paul Schreiner and people here.
And good to see Leo and Kamagita here.
And it's good to be here on Sangha Day. So probably some of you have been around the centre for a long time. Some of you might be a bit newer. So just say a little bit about what Sangha Day is. You may know that we talk quite a lot about the three jewels. Here they are on my kesa, three flaming jewels. The Buddha jewel. The Buddha is the founder of the Buddhist tradition, and also he represents enlightenment in the way that notion that it's possible to wake up and see the truth and then live entirely according to it is the heart of everything that we do. And then Blue Jewel is the Dharma, the teachings or the truth. So that's both in the reality that the Buddha saw, that he realized, and then the ways in which he was able to put what he'd understood into ideas, into words, into teachings that we, and practices as well. All the practices we do are attempts by the Buddha to communicate what he understood, what he understood about the mind, what he understood about the truth. And then we have the red jewel, which is Sangha. Padma Singha intimated earlier, sometimes Sangha can mean a number of different things. It can mean all of those people who have gained some kind of understanding, who therefore represent truth. We call that the Arya Sangha. But more particularly, and especially in our movement, the Triratna Buddhist Order, we talk about Sangha mainly as those Buddhists, so other people with whom we're actually in contact daily or in the course of our lives. So it's Sangha then is an aspect of our lives. It means that we're by having a whole festival celebrating Sangha, which isn't really something you find in many other Buddhist traditions, we're saying that it's not this whole process of trying to practice the Dharma isn't just about developing ourselves. It's not just about understanding the truth for myself. It's not just about becoming a better person in myself. There's another dimension, because it's really partial to think to think of ourselves in isolation in that way. We're social beings. You really see that this as a parent. You know, parents are children when they're Leo's age. They're not entirely separate from you. You know, of course, he is an individual. I need to remember he's not just a bit of me. But we're not completely isolated individuals. And Sangha is acknowledgement of that. And it's saying that in practicing the Dharma, in trying to become like the Buddha, that's something we do along with other people. We do it, we learn from others, we share with others, but most importantly, we share our lives with others as we try to practice. So, yes, Sangha means the people we're in direct contact with. That might mean our friends. It might mean people at a centre such as this. It might mean wider connections we have with other people in our particular Buddhist movement, the Triratna Buddhist community, or even other Buddhist communities. And then beyond that, we can maybe think slightly, perhaps in inverted commas, we can try to create Sangha-like situations in other areas of our lives, in our family life and our work life even. The extent to which we can create more harmony, better communication, more friendship, more openness, more mutual understanding. To that extent, you could say, we're practicing Sangha. We're taking what we develop, particularly in the Buddhist Sangha, into other situations. So Sangha is an ideal, rather like the Buddha, rather like the Dharma. But it's different from the Buddha and the Dharma in quite an important respect, which is, whereas we can think, well, the Buddha was pretty much he pretty much got it sorted out, that, you know, how it is to live. I mean, he didn't have an easy life, and he wasn't... he had his own personality, which had its own quirks, I think, having written a book about Buddha. But nonetheless, we can regard enlightenment, we can regard the Buddha as enlightened, and we can regard enlightenment as something that is, in a way, an ideal. And the same with the Dharma. The Dharma is true for all times and all places, regardless of whether there's anyone there to realise it. But the Sangha is made up of frail human beings like me and you. This is one reason why we also talk about the Arya Sangha, of people who have gained stream entry or, you know, one of these exalted states along the spiritual path, which isn't made up of frail people. It's made up of partially enlightened people. So, but for the rest of us, and in terms of our daily experience of Sangha, in terms of our experience of the centre, of this our particular Buddhist movement, of our friends, we can't expect that to be ideal. Sangha is, in that sense, a practice, rather like meditation is a practice. You know, we learn pretty quickly that when we meditate, we don't simply enter into one of these states that might be described and sound really wonderful when you read a book. What happens is that there may well be nothing wrong with the practice, but what we bring to that practice is ourselves, our mind, with whatever's going on in our mind. And the art of meditation is very much bringing those two things together. How can this practice be meaningful given what's going on in my life right now, given where my thoughts are right now, given how I'm feeling? How can I bring concentration, stillness into my experience to work from where I am right now? So, yeah, the Sangha isn't perfect. That's one of the things I want to explore, the imperfections of the Sangha. But I don't want to do that by talking about the imperfections of our Sangha. That would be rather tendentious, rather boring, and rather unhelpful, I think. But actually, if we look at the Sangha, the community that the Buddha founded himself, we can see all sorts of parallels with our own experience. And I want to talk about a series of stories concerning the Buddha. And they run together in some of the Buddhist scriptures. Oh, thank you. So, let's take our minds back to the Buddha himself and to the community that he established. And that does mean taking ourselves back in time, 2,500 years, and to a very different society from our own, a very different... So, where were we? Shramanas. Yes, the homeless ones who didn't have all those ties to household life and all the distractions that they bring. Very different from my situation. So, so the Buddha just left home and there were places you could go and people you could join with. They wandered around together, mostly in groups. They stayed outside towns. And then they went into the towns or the villages to bake their food. And there were lots and lots of different philosophies, lots of different groups, lots of teachers. So when the Buddha left home, he first of all went to different teachers for his own guidance. But in the end, he found himself practicing on his own and searching for the truth on his own. He didn't want to do that through the medium of all sorts of views and beliefs and philosophies. What he wanted to do in the end was strip all of that away and just look, what is my actual experience? What's it telling me? How can I guide it? How can I guide it in a way that opens up to the truth? And having learned that art through solitary meditation primarily, he gained enlightenment. at that point, or at least a little while after that, he decided to teach, and you probably know the story of his first teaching. He taught to his former companions in spiritual life, and they got it. They got what he was talking about. They became what's called stream entrants in their own right. They had really deeply understood the fundamental point that he was making, which is that the mind conditions itself, and therefore everything we experience is something that comes out of conditions. We can therefore create that, create a more satisfactory experience of life by the way that we respond to what happens. So the Buddha communicated that, people got the point, and then he had a community on his hands. Quickly, he attracted a lot of people. Many of them, according to the early accounts, gained enlightenment or some degree of enlightenment very, very quickly. And then he said, off you go. He didn't just want to be a guru with a big following all around him. He told them to go off to share the teachings that they'd understood from him, share the practices that they'd understood for the benefit of all beings, for the benefit of, for the welfare of the many. So off they went. And he also said, look, if you've been ordained into this community for a certain time, you can give the going forth, you can give ordination to people yourself. So he created a decentralized structure in which groups of monks could confer ordination themselves. They didn't have to ask him, they didn't have to check back to HQ or the shram, the ordination process. They could do it themselves. And also they were, so in other words, what he'd established was his own Shramana community. And they had a name, they were called Shakyaputras, sons of the Shakyan. He was the teacher from Shakya, hence the Shakyan. They were Shakyaputras, sons of the Shakyas. And when the women started to be ordained, they were called Shakyaditas, daughters of the Shakyan, the Shakyan. So we can call them Shakyaputras for short. And the Shakyaputras had to find out how to form a community. And this wasn't somewhere where you could just have National Order weekends and get together all together and have conventions. You know, you had to walk everywhere. I mean, the Shramanas weren't allowed to go in carts, for example. So they had to walk. They couldn't walk during the rainy season. So that was actually when they came together. And as well as that, the Buddha put a great emphasis on going off on your own, practicing in a solitary way in the wilderness. So this was a very, very diffuse, diverse community, very decentralized. And what kept it together was a shared understanding of the Buddhist teachings. And then they needed to find ways to make sure that that was passed on. And also a shared lifestyle. As time went by, the Buddha started to tweak the Shramana lifestyle, which, I mean, the basic lifestyle meant you know, having very few possessions and being celibate and homeless and so on. But then he started to tweak it. I mean, there were different ways in which the Shramanas treated their hair. For example, so some of them had long kind of dreadlocks. And you still see this among Indian sadhus. Some of them shaved their hair, much more convenient. But how do you get the hair out? The Jains pulled it out. They plucked it out by the roots. I saw someone wince at that point. They still do it. So the Buddha was, generally speaking, fairly moderate about all of these choices they had to make about lifestyle. So he said, you can shave it. Once it gets to a finger's length, it needs to be shaved again. But, you know, so some of us wouldn't have had too many problems. So this community, this diverse community, with these amazing people, people going off, getting enlightened, you know, ex-Brahmins coming in with all their Brahmin views and arguing with each other about, you know, should this be more like Brahmanism? People from all sorts of different backgrounds, some of them very intellectual, according to the early sources, some of them former priests, some of them, well, you know, we've got experiences. We've got stories about people who've been former murderers, prostitutes, robbers, merchants, etc., etc. You know, the whole gamut. Former aristocrats, former untouchables, in inverted commas. All coming together in these communities. And not necessarily seeing very much of the Buddha. So sometimes things look wrong. And the classic story about things going wrong is set in a place called Kasumbi. Kasumbi is out of the main, the central area of the Ganges Valley where the Buddha lived. And it's over to the west and down to the south in a kingdom called, then was called Kashi. And these monks in Kasumbi are famously quarrelsome. So let me read you. I want to basically talk about a particular Buddhist text called the Kasumbiya Sutta, which is from the middle length sayings of the Majjhima Nikaya. At that time, the Blessed One was living in Gosta's monastery in Kasumbi. At that time, the bhikkhus of Kasumbi had aroused a dispute and were quarrelling with each other, throwing sharp words at each other. They would not discuss the matter among themselves and come to an understanding. So I've cut this down a bit, but it's in, sorry, it's not cutting down. In some of the translations, it says they used words like they were stabbing each other with their words. So the words were weapons that they were using against each other, which is quite a strong image, but quite a good one, actually. Sticks and stones may break my bones. Words will never hurt me, except that you can use words as if they were sticks and stones. You know where to put the words, then it's like stabbing someone. And they would not discuss the matter amongst themselves and come to an understanding. So in this text, which is probably the oldest version of the story, it doesn't say why they were in dispute. Actually, it doesn't really matter. But later versions said that it was all to do with a dispute over monastic rules, that a senior monk had left water in the latrine and he hadn't taken it out afterwards. And then someone had said, you shouldn't have done that. And he said, oh, well, there's nothing wrong with doing that. And so the other monk said, you need to confess. And he said, no, I don't. And so this became a serious dispute, which then ended up with him being expelled from the order, but saying, I shouldn't have been expelled. I didn't do anything wrong. And then his followers were in agreement with that, that something really bad had happened by him being expelled for this reason. Whereas the other monks said, no, this is appalling. You know, you've been told you need to leave the order and you're not following the majority agreement of the monks. And in this way, a dispute arose. The point is really, big problems can grow from small causes. And we see this in our lives. You can really fall out with people, and to such a point you can't quite remember what it was you're actually disagreeing about. Because after a while, the disagreement comes about the way in which they talk to me about it and the way in which you then responded to them. And underneath it, the actual pointed issue might not be that big, but nonetheless, what happens, of course, is that we bring to this fissure, this dispute, this difference of opinion, all of our underlying feelings about the other people. So then the Blessed One said to those bhikkhus, is it true you've aroused dispute amongst yourselves, quarrelling with yourselves, quarrelling with each other, throwing sharp words at each other? You wouldn't discuss the matter among yourselves and come to an understanding. And that last bit is important. You wouldn't come discuss the matter among yourselves and come to an understanding. Yes, Venerable Sir. Bhikkhus, at a time when you've aroused dispute among yourselves, a quarrelling with yourselves, are throwing sharp words at each other? Are you established in bodily actions of loving kindness towards associates in the holy life, openly and secretly? Established in verbal actions of loving kindness towards co-associates in the holy life, openly and secretly? Established in mental actions of loving kindness towards associates in holy life, openly and secretly? No, venerable sir. And then he says, foolish men, seeing what good have you aroused this dispute? You do not discuss this matter amongst yourself and come to an understanding. Foolish men, this will be for your undoing for a long time. So, the important thing to take from this, I think, is the Buddha isn't really concerned with the rights and wrongs of, you know, of these two parties. He doesn't even go into that. He doesn't set up a judicial process to try to understand it. His concern is, how are they talking about it? And he asks, I understand you've got a problem, but the main thing I've been trying to tell you is not about the letter of all of these regulations and who's right and who's wrong. The main thing he'd been trying to communicate was a spirit, and particularly the spirit of relating through loving kindness, through metta. So even if we're right, the Buddha isn't suggesting, we go wrong when we get angry and reactive. Right in inverted commas. And the test is what we do when difficulties arise. This is very important in the Sangha because, as I said before, we can have high expectations of the Sangha. We can imagine that it's this ideal community. And then what often happens is that some kind of difficulty arises. We fall out with someone. People act in ways that we think they shouldn't. We feel let down by them. And the practice of Sangha doesn't stop then. That doesn't mean that Sangha has failed. What the Buddha is telling these monks is that the practice of Sangha starts then. Practice of Sangha starts, and this is, you know, leaving aside just Sangha. It's the same with metta. It's not that we feel loving kindness for people when they're nice to us. The practice of metta really kicks in when people aren't nice to us. And that's a real test of our practice. And it's a test, or rather it's an opportunity to practice. So the Buddha's throwing the responsibility right back on the monks. And so many of the difficulties that we experience in our lives, or even the difficulties that we see in our society, develop in a certain sort of way. When we look out there and we see what's wrong with the world, we see what's wrong with the society, and of course there are all sorts of things wrong with society. We then feel justified in getting angry about it. And the Buddha's teaching is, you know, forget about the rights and wrongs of it for the time being. The main practice that he's encouraging is that we respond in a positive, love, kindly way. Doesn't mean we don't notice when there are difficulties and we don't seek to address them, which is what he's telling them to do. But when we try to address things in a spirit of harmony and loving kindness, solutions are much more possible than when we do them on the basis, we address, approach them on the basis of reactivity. Oh dear. Now the monks ignore the Buddha's intervention, and he keeps on trying. They say, look, you give us the teachings, we'll take responsibility for how we are as monks. you know, we'll sort this out ourselves, off you go. And they get back into their disputes. Fights break out. And, you know, this is in the, as I said, there are various versions of this story. In later versions, it becomes a whole kind of contention. In fact, in later Buddhist legend, Buddhist mythology, Kasumbi and the quarrel at Kasumbi, which I think probably does actually describe the real difficulties that happened as the Buddha was forming his community. It becomes a kind of a symbol for it becomes a sort of apocalyptic, and it's said that the Dharma will end with schisms, fighting, and disputes, which will always start at Kasumbi. Each time a Buddha comes along, there will always be factions, and they will always arise at Kasumbi. I mean, don't go and live in Kasumbi. Don't have Buddhist centres in Kasumbi would be a simple solution. But in the end, the entire Sangha is destroyed in some of these legends by a war in which all the monks kill each other because of a problem, a dispute that started at Kasumbi. So this is really the way that mythology elaborates on what was probably just a difficult situation. But it's interesting. It shows that even when you've got the Buddha around, the Buddha, and they did regard him as, you know, pretty special, even in his own day. Even when he was around, in his own lifetime, they had all sorts of problems in the Sangha. Even when he went to visit, even when he was very direct with people and said, just stop it now, they ignored him. So it's kind of interesting in terms of, you know, especially if you think of the Buddha as this cosmic being who's sitting on a lotus and surrounded by all sorts of other cosmic beings, which is what you get in later Buddhist texts. You don't get any of this sort of thing, where people just ignore him and tell him to go off, go away and leave him alone. But that's absolutely what you've got in the earlier material. So, the Buddha says this. He gives them a teaching. He says there are six things that conduce to reverence, unity, friendliness, and love for each other. What six? First of all, the bhikkhu should be established. The bhikkhu should be established in bodily actions of loving kindness towards co-associates in the holy life, openly and secretly. So then it's, in other words, we should treat each other with metta in our bodily actions, and then our verbal actions, and then our mental actions. So the bodily actions means things that we do, how we act with our bodies. What that means, very simply, is it's really important to be kind to each other. We want to help the centre. Well, we can give money. That's a good thing to do. I don't want to discourage you from doing that. You can help out around the centre. But those are expressions of kindness. But actually, what the Buddha's saying is, look, if you want to help the Sangha, be kind to each other. Act with metta towards each other. Interesting, isn't it? It's not just, oh, it's my practice of metta and I'll become a more loving person. That will make for a better world. It will make for a better Sangha. And the same, I think, is true in the rest of our lives. You know, if you want to have a better family, act kindly to the people around you. Interesting. And then how we speak. And it says openly and in secret. And then we come on to mind as well. So, just go back to the first one. I just want to underline again a danger in this, in the way that we can take this. We hear all this stuff about how the Sangha should be characterized by metta. And then we have experience, we have expectations that everyone should be nice to us. that if we're in need, we think the Sangha will come to our rescue, or Sangha will help us. And in other words, we have certain kind of expectations. And I've seen people really become very disillusioned when those aren't met. One person I knew, she got pregnant and it was very difficult for her. She thought everyone should rally round. She hadn't been around the Sangha for very long. They didn't really. They did a bit, but they didn't meet her needs, which were enormous at the time. And she blamed them and she left the Sangha. So you see things like that happen. You think, And she said that the Sangha had failed because they hadn't been kind to her in the way that they wanted her to be kind to her. So that's not really the point. You can't have those expectations. If we do, we're likely to come disappointed. The point is not what we get. The point is what we can give. In fact, we should expect the Sangha to disappoint us. We should expect our friends to disappoint us and be delighted when they don't. So, verbal, speaking kindly, openly and in secret. Actually, the kindness is openly and in secret, which is quite nice. You know, this idea of these secret acts of kindness, which is that line of Wordsworth, is unremembered acts of kindness. And the words that we use, openly and in secret. So how we talk about each other, not just to each other's face, not just in public situations, but in private, it's very important. It's very easy to get into gossip, into kind of politics, the letting off steam about each other behind each other's backs. And what the Buddha's saying is that has an effect. What we say in private will have an effect. It'll have an effect because private things quickly become public. Someone says, oh yeah, this person said that. And it'll have an effect because it influences how we think about things. Not that we can't discuss difficulties, we need to be careful about how we do so. And it's even important how we think about each other. So mental actions, openly and in secret. So it's important that we cultivate kindly thoughts about one another. Again, so the fourth point, the fourth of the Buddha's six things that conduce to reverence, unity, friendliness, and love. Again, a bhikkhu gains, whatever a bhikkhu gains, rightfully, as far as what's put into the bowl, the bhikkhu would not partake without sharing equally with the co-associates in the whole life. In other words, whatever you have, you should share. That's what he's saying. Even the food that you bake from the alms round. So again, this is a thing that conduces to unity, sharing sharing whatever we have with each other, to the extent that that's possible. In the one of the versions of this story, which comes in a text called the Vinaya, or the Vinaya, which is the monastic code. This story about Kasumbi is mixed with a couple of other stories. One of them is the story of three monks called the Anuruddhas, who live together and exemplify this practice of sharing. I'm just going to read you the description of how they live. First of all, the Buddha goes to visit them, actually having got fed up with the Kasumbi monks. He just, I've had enough of these people. I'm going to see my mates. And he says, how are you getting on? They say, well, we practice loving kindness towards each other. Body speech, mind. It's really good. So then he says, all right, what else do you do? Well, we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. Oh, well done. How? Well, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, puts the refuse bucket in its place, lays a table, in other words. Whichever of us returns last, eats any food left over if he wishes. Otherwise, he throws it away where there's no greenery, or drops it into water where there's no life. He puts away the seats and water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it, and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low or empty, takes care of them. If they're too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of his hand, and they move it by joining hands. Don't even need to talk. But because of this, we do not break out into speech. Every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing the Dharma. This is how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. So, it's interesting that in the midst of all of these rather high-sounding attainments that the monks are expected to have, really, Aniruddha's bring it right back to very down-to-earth details of daily life. Who does the washing up? Who makes the food? Who prepares the seats? Who clears out the refuse bucket? And they just do it. You know, they just do it when it's needed. So that's really a beautiful description of what life was like for the monks when it was going well. And they could form these very intense little pockets because they were away from other people. They were practicing very diligently. And it was kind of a combination. It was a middle way between the communal life with lots of monks all around and the solitary life. So these monks are having a kind of retreat life together. Now that might be a little outside the sphere that we can imagine, but nonetheless the virtues that they're expressing are very relevant, I think. And so they also talk about sharing the dhyanas, you know, these higher mental states. But the basis is by cooperating in terms of the practical affairs. And so just as little things can lead to big quarrels, so little actions of kindness and cooperation and helping each other can have quite a profound effect on the conditions that we create between ourselves. So again, fifth point, the bhikkhu becomes equal in virtues with co-associates in the holy life. Virtues that are not broken, fissured, or spotted, consistent and praised by the wise. So what the Buddha is saying here is remembering that these are all points about how you ensure the unity and the harmony of the Sangha. He's saying, you know, in the end, it comes down to the qualities and virtues that each of us has in our own lives, in our own mind, that are that we develop through our practice. And one part of that is confession. The Buddha goes on later on in the sutra, I won't be going through the whole thing, to talk about confession. And what that means really is, I think the important point in talking about the practice of confession is it's really encouraging us to be open with each other. And you can confess formally, and that can be a good thing to do. But the main point is that there aren't parts of our lives that we keep hidden away and secret from everyone. Now, you might not want to share those parts with all and sundry in the Sangha, and I think that's quite reasonable. But that there are people with whom you do talk about the most difficult things, the things you're ashamed of, things you'd really wish you didn't do or you hadn't done. that kind of really intimate openness, I think, is important. And if we don't do that, then there might be, if we don't talk with other people about these aspects of our lives, we can't really resolve them for ourselves in relation to our own lives. You get the point that I'm making. But by talking with someone else, it's out there. And then you can really think about it. The things that we just try and work out for ourselves in the privacy of our own minds, somehow that isn't quite enough. But I think it's important to be intelligent about how we go about approaching that confession. We can establish formal contexts. We do that a bit in the chapters, going for refuge groups and so on. There is value in that. But it needs to be in the context of communication, because it's not just saying, oh, I did this thing wrong. Oh, I'm terribly sorry. Do you accept my confession? And everyone says, oh, yes, we accept your confession, if you're really sure that you really mean it. Because often we need to a context where we can explore why do I do that? Why do I snap at people? Why do I do it? You know, it's not just enough. It doesn't get you very far. Just confess it. You need to be able to bring some light, shed some light on what are the emotions involved that are leading you to do that. And then you can maybe make some, you can address those emotions. So that's my book on confession. And for the final point that the Buddha makes about the practices that lead to the harmony in the Sangha, is he talks about views. What are our beliefs? What are the ideas in our minds? What do we believe? How do we think? And how does that influence our actions? Particularly, actually, when he goes into it in detail, he talks about mental states. So it isn't just I believe in God or something that won't conduce to Sangha. He is talking about that, but he's not only talking about that. He's talking about the kind of mental states that we have that lead us that go along with our views, particularly the five hindrances. If we see them, we need to address them. But more fundamentally, do we believe that, as the Buddha says, hatred is not overcome by hatred? Hatred is only overcome by love. That is an eternal law. The commentary to a text called those lines, which are very famous lines by the Buddha, come from a text called the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada has a commentary. The commentary always says when he gave that particular teaching. According to the Dhammapada commentary, he gave those lines to the monks at Kasumbi. That's a little descent into geekiness for those Buddhist geeks out there. So, hatred is not overcome by hatred. Hatred is only overcome by love. And the Buddha is saying to the monks at Kasumbi, do you actually believe that? Do you actually believe that? Because what you're doing right now is the opposite of it. If you believe that hatred is not overcome by hatred, why are you expressing hatred towards each other? So can we just leave out the hatred and have a proper discussion here? That's all we're saying. Do we believe that? Well, yes, rationally we believe it, maybe. But do we believe it emotionally? And what do we believe emotionally if we don't believe that? If we don't act in that way, then it suggests that in some sense we don't. And how can we work with that? So the Buddha's asking us to be honest with ourselves and with others at these quite deep levels if we want to avoid disputes. So just to go through the process again. Buddha's seen this dispute between the monks. He says, look, you need to practice metta. You need to act with loving kindness. But then he goes and he throws it back on them. He says, it's not about the rights and wrongs of the situation. It's about how you're talking about this problem. Then he says, so what are you actually doing publicly and privately with your actions, with your speech and with your mind? Are you acting, you know, is there meta there or is there not? He says, how do you act to each other in quite practical ways in terms of sharing what you have or hoarding what you have? He says, you know, really, what's going on with your character if you're not managing this, or if you are managing this? What virtues are there? And finally, what do you actually believe about all of this? So he's throwing the responsibility back onto the monks on all of those levels and saying, you know, this is what it means to practice metta, taking it into our thoughts, taking it into our views, taking it into our character traits. And that's what we need to do if we wish to avoid disputes, or when we find ourselves, rather when we find ourselves in disputes, that's what a creative response looks like, according to this sutta. Now, the Buddha, as I said before, couldn't get the monks to listen. Then he visited the Anuruddhas. So I'm going to finish with the third part of this story as it appears in the Vinaya, which is apparently not really in keeping with the spirit of Sangha, but another level it is. The Buddha just goes off into the forest. He's seen his nice Anuruddha friends, but he's had enough of all of this dispute and all of these daggers and everyone ignoring him, and he is enlightened after all. He's just trying to teach the Dharma. I mean, remember that when he was under the Bodhi tree, thinking, you know what, I could just sit here. And then the myth is Brahma comes along and says, no, there are all these beings who need your help. And then he sees a bed of lotuses and he says, oh, yes, different stages of unfoldment. They could all come fully into bloom. But he's reluctant to do it. And I think that tells us something about the character of the Buddha. He likes just hanging out in the dhyanas. He just enjoys it. He loves going off to the forest and being on his own. It's one very memorable line in the suttas. He says, when I'm on my own, just walking down the forest path, I don't see anyone ahead of me. I don't see anyone behind me. Then I'm happy. I'm happy whatever I'm doing, even if I'm urinating or defecating. this is what he does in the Vinaya. He goes off. He says, formerly, I did not live at ease. Go back a bit. Then the Buddha went to the Paralaya Grove, the foot of the Buddhasala tree. And then he thinks, formerly, I did not live at ease, being troubled by those litigious, contentious, quarrelsome, disputatious bhikkhus of Kasumbi. The constant raisers of questions before the Sangha, troublemakers. But now, being alone, without a companion, I live pleasantly and at ease. And there also dwelt there a noble elephant, who was surrounded by a crowd of elephants, she-elephants, elephant calves, and young elephants. The blades of grass, when he went to eat the blades of grass, their tips were broken. And when he waded into the river and plunged into the water, the she-elephants came and rubbed up their bodies against him. Now, that noble elephant thought, what if I were to live alone, far away from these crowds? And that noble elephant left the herd behind him and went to the place where the Blessed One was. Having approached him, he administered with his trunk to the Blessed One, with water to drink and food, and removed the grass from that place. And then that elephant thought, formerly I did not live at ease, but now, being alone, without a companion, I live pleasantly at ease, remote from those elephants, she-elephants, elephant calves and young elephants. And the Buddha, both regarding his own retirement and understanding the power of his mind, the thoughts that had risen in the mind of the little elephant, on that occasion pronounced this solemn utterance. Thus the mind of the noble one and the noble elephant with tusks like cart poles harmonize in this. They take delight living alone in the forest. So we have this image of two grumpy old men. One of them's enlightened and one of them's an elephant. And sometimes it's like that with the Sangha, isn't it? You know, we do need to make this practice by our families as well, actually. We do need to make a practice of trying to address issues. And sometimes we need to just get away from it. So and that's part of Sangha as well. You know, the times when we withdraw, the times when we go off on retreat, and the times when we come back, all of that, for me, makes up the practice of Sangha.